Professor Strauss, Session 8, Political Philosophy of Plato, April 21st, 1965.
Any other announcements? If not, we will turn after this long interruption to the protocol. Let us only remind ourselves of the context. Protagoras claims to teach well-advisedness regarding domestic and political matters. Socrates calls it for the political art. But Socrates doubts that it can be taught. Protagoras chooses of his own free will to prove his contention that it can be taught by a myth. The myth has externally four stages. First, the gods beneath the earth produce something which we called living matter, with a highly appropriate but colloquially intelligible expression. Second, Epimetheus is working also beneath the earth, which means without light and blindly, supplies that matter with specific faculties or natures, i.e. he makes the various races of animals, but in such a way that man remains unsupplied with such natural powers. The implication is that nature is a stepmother to man, or generalized, nature is bad. Art remedies the defects of nature. There are allusions to this thought, which is of course very common to us in modern times, conquest of nature, nature the enemy, but there are some traces of that in classical thought. I referred on a former occasion to a remark in the first book of the Republic to this effect. Now the third stage, Prometheus steals the arts from Hephaestus and Athena. He steals them. The Olympian gods, to whom these two gods belong, are as unkind or malicious as the Septerenius gods, to say nothing of Epimetheus. But the fourth stage, even after having acquired their arts, men are still unable to live, since they are unable to live together. They lack the political art, which is identified here by Prometheus with sense of shame and sense of right. This is not stolen from any god, because it would be absurd to present a sense of right as due to a crime, but a gift of Zeus. Now the implication here is clear. There is as fundamental a difference between nature and technique and art as is the difference between art and morality, to use a convenient modern term, what the Greeks would call the noble and the just things. This much we have read last time. I have to ask Mr. Reinden to reread the last passage where I interrupted in 322d5. That is after this conversation with Zeus, between Zeus and Hermes. Yeah?
When he addresses Socrates.
Yeah, that is important. Now, for the first time, he addresses Socrates. It is, of course, not proper to the style of a myth that you should use the name of a contemporary man. I mean, a myth belonged to the olden days, and Socrates lives now in 431 or so, 32. Good?
And this is the reason, Socrates, why the Athenians and mankind in general, when the question relates to excellence in carpentry or any other craftsmanly art, allow but a few to share in their deliberations. And when anyone else interferes, then, as you say, they object if he be not...
It's mostly if anyone outside of these few, the few experts, in every such question there is a small minority which is capable to give advice. Yeah? Yes?
They object if he be not of the few, which, as I reply, is very natural. But when they meet to deliberate about political excellence or virtue, which proceeds only by way of justice and self-control, they are patient enough of any man who speaks of them, as a matter of course, because they think that every man ought to share in this sort of virtue, and that cities could not exist if this were otherwise. I have explained to you, Socrates, the reason of this phenomenon.
But literally the cause. This, Socrates, is the cause of that. He again addresses Socrates directly. Now, Protagoras vindicates the Athenian practice as reasonable. But he does not say, as Socrates did, that the Athenians are particularly wise. Protagoras doesn't make any compliments to the Athenians. He's not prudent. He says that this practice is common to all men. And he, in contradistinction to Socrates, who simply stated the brute fact, Protagoras gives the cause, the reason for the practice. And the reason is, as we have seen already last time, in the first place, Zeus's law. Everyone should partake in it. But ultimately, as also was said in the discussion last time, behind that law of Zeus is a necessity. There couldn't be human survival without cities, and there couldn't be cities without political virtue. Zeus replaces, no, Socrates replaces, I think. Yeah, I'm sorry, Protagoras replaces what Zeus had called a sense of shame by moderation. There is a certain kinship between the two things, as you can easily see. If you want to go deeper into that, you must study the first two books of Plato's Laws, where this connection is explained. And he replaces dike, which I translated by right or sense of right, but which also has the meaning of punishment. For example, in 322a2, he speaks of the punishment which Prometheus received for his death, using here the word dike. He replaces dike by dikaiosyne, by the ordinary word for justice. In connection with this, he mentions no punishment except annihilation. Those who cannot partake of political virtue must be annihilated. Those who are unable, me dynaminoi, the term occurs at the beginning of Aristotle's Politics when he speaks of the men who are unable to live in a polis, 1253a8 following. But most important is here the symbol identification of the political art with political virtue, and they are, which to begin with is absolutely strange, to a demand from every citizen high-class statesmanship is plain nonsense, but from everyone one can expect that he has the simple citizen virtues. And but here the political art is as much to be demanded of all men as the other. We can only later on find out what this means. He speaks also here of the craftsmanly virtue, not of the craftsmanly art. Here, in all, here too, virtue and knowledge are identified. And this is done not by Socrates, but by Protagoras. So the identification of knowledge and virtue, for which Socrates is so famous, is here attributed to Protagoras. A similar case, not so clear, occurs in the Gorgias, 160b, where Gorgias accepts without any further ado the assertion of Socrates that he who knows the just things does the just things. It's the same. This is, of course, not an unfair attribution to this sophist or rhetorician by Socrates. It is implied in Protagoras' claim. Hippias will become better and better by virtue of Protagoras' teaching. That means, just by listening to Protagoras, by learning, by acquiring knowledge, he will become better. He will learn well-advisedness, or what Socrates calls the political art. Virtue is a piece of learning, a mathema, something that can be brought about by speeches, in particular by persuasive speeches. In other words, the political art is identical with rhetoric, which is described as a thesis of the sophists by Aristotle at toward the end of the Nicomachean Ethics. I have dealt with this matter. I deliberately do not wish to bring it up now, but those who are interested, in The City and Man on page 23, if you read this page once or twice, you will see how crucial that issue is. So, the conclusion which I drew there is this, which I did not draw there, that Socrates, in contradistinction with the sophists, seems to agree with that, that virtue is knowledge. But according to Socrates, it's not rhetoric, but dialectics, which is or is productive of virtue. And therefore, of course, we would have to know much more than we do now how dialectics can make a man good. But let us return to the context. The myth was to dispose of the conflict between Protagoras' claim, the famous foreigner, and the view of the Athenians. The Athenians have, of course, no objection to men acquiring virtue, especially in the sense of justice and moderation, through teachers or any other man. But they do object to a tiny minority among them acquiring the political art of statesmanship. That's to say, the Athenians do make a distinction between the political art and the political virtue, the virtue by which the city stands and falls. Or, to use a later term, they do make a distinction between the political art and moral virtue, of which justice and moderation are key parts. Protagoras abolishes this distinction. The political art is identical with justice and moderation. Perhaps even more important is this, that according to the myth, the political art, in the sense of justice and moderation, is a gift of Zeus. What does this imply, if it is a gift of Zeus?
It's very good.
Pardon? Very good. Now, everyone would admit, in everyone in his senses would admit that justice and moderation are good. But it has there is another non-trivial indication. If it is a gift of Zeus...
Can it be taught?
Yes. It doesn't have to be taught. So, and this leaves our good Protagoras on a limb. The myth is inept. Protagoras, but why did he tell a myth? Because he wanted to tell a myth. his choice was inept. He lacks that quality of well-advisedness which he claims to teach. We have to return to this point later when we are through, when we have considered the secret. Now, yes.
Oh, I just wondering, still can he claim to be a high priest or a man who has discerned the message of the gods better than others?
But if it is a gift of Zeus, if everyone coming to him has it already, what can he do? Yeah? I believe the sequel confirms this interpretation, but I would like to make here a few remarks which I believe are necessary about the myth in Plato in general, because this is a very broad topic and we must not, we must be mindful of it. Now, that originally the terms mythos and logos had the same meaning as speech. But this, the distinction and even opposition between them antedates Plato. And in according to this more recent usage, a myth is an untrue story. For example, in Republic 377a, or in the Phaedo, Socrates says, poets must make myth, but not logos. And the poets are by definition liars, makers of things which are not. The question is, of course, why does Plato use myth? Or in other words, what is a Platonic myth, which is not the same as any other myth? Now, to answer this question, of course, the only decent way to proceed is to go through the writings of Plato with a pencil in one's hand and see here is a myth, here's a myth. And one should perhaps say to begin with, for someone who wants to be very conscientious, that only the statements which are called mythical by Plato or his spokesman, here we are already on treacherous grounds, you see, are to be counted as mythical. If we apply this standard, we would arrive at the conclusion that the myth at the end of the Gorgias is not a myth, because Socrates explicitly says, you, Callicles, will think it is a myth, but it is a logos, in fact. The presentation of the best regime in the Republic is explicitly called a myth. You see how far this would lead us. Let us therefore not be too strict or pedantic or in a way too unpedantic, because we assume always we must not identify the spokesman, the so-called spokesman, with Plato without great caution. Let me say that the myth is an account which lacks evidence, sapheneia, and which nevertheless claims to make manifest what is. Myths will therefore deal with things regarding which knowledge is impossible, or at least very difficult to obtain. Now, what are such things? For example, the things of the most ancient antiquity. They are always unknown, even today, because whatever finds anthropologists and paleontologists may make, there is always, you come back finally to a period where you have only bones and no tools. And what was going on in this very interesting stage, where there were no tools, and yet human beings of the sort, this of course is wholly unknowable. It can never be known. So the very old things, for example, in the laws, in the Critias, in the states, things of very old times are told explicitly as myth. But there are other things which are unknowable. The interior of heaven, for example. Well, we know much more today than Plato did, but even today there are, no one has been there, even on the moon. to say nothing of other planetary systems, and also the interior of the Earth was at that time regarded as unknown. Therefore, cosmology, account of heaven and earth, can become an ingredient of myth, as in the Phaedo and in the myth of the 10th book of the Republic. To some extent, Plato's own great cosmological work, the Timaeus, is a myth. It is explicitly called a plausible myth. So it is distinguished from the other ones, which are not plausible, but it is still a myth. But above all, among these things which are not easy of access, is the soul, and especially its fate prior to birth and after death. The myths in the Apology, in the Gorgias, in the Republic, in the Phaedo, and in the Phaedrus deal with these themes. On the other hand, as a curiosity, Diotima's account of the ancestry of Eros is not called by her a myth. In the present day discussions, this account is always taken as part of it, but she does not call it a myth. Why? That is a long question. Now, myths, however, need not be necessary, because the truth cannot be strictly speaking known. Myth may also be necessary because the truth cannot be said. It's a possibility. Now let us cast a glance at the myth told by Socrates, to simplify matters. In the Gorgias, Socrates introduces this what everyone calls a myth, except Socrates, that he has heard an account, and on the basis of what he has heard, he figured out certain things. He drew certain inferences from what he has heard. This is probably the reason why he says it is not a myth, but a logos, because on the basis of these accounts he has figured out. In the Apology of Socrates, Socrates tells a myth on the basis of what people say. This applies also to the myth in the Phaedo. In the 10th book of the Republic, the myth is told by Socrates, but ascribed by him to Ear, the Armenian. So it is in a way not Socrates' story. In the Critias, the story is told by old Egyptian priests. In the Phaedrus, it is ascribed to the poet Cicurus. Now, this we get one understanding of the Protagoras myth at once. You see, the point is this: we must, just as in military strategy it is, has been said, hit them where they aimed. It is in our kind of strategy also necessary to see what aimed where, i.e. what is not said. Now, if you compare the Protagoras myth with others, we see immediately Protagoras does not refer to anything said, to any tradition, to anything that has come. He does not even claim to be based on tradition. It is a mere invention. There is only one slight exception in 322a when he speaks of the punishment of Prometheus. He says, as is said, but this is of course not a very important part of the story. On the contrary, this singular reference to what is said brings out the silence on what is said in all other matters. There is a parallel to this, another story by a sophist, Prodicus, in Xenophon's Memorabilia, Book 2, Chapter 1, the famous fable of Heracles at the parting of the ways, should he go to take the way of virtue or of vice. And also, no reference to any tradition. The open invention of the myth seems to be a characteristic of these men as distinguished from Socrates. Another characteristic of the Protagoras myth is this. If you would compare it with the other myths, we would see that the other myths are always preceded by a logos, by a reasoned argument. Here, Protagoras begins with a myth without any preparation. And lastly, but above all, it is extremely simple to translate Protagoras' myth as a whole into non-mythical language. I believe I gave you a specimen of that. One can say it is as little mysterious as Voltaire's Candide, if you have ever read that. Candide also has its mysteries, but they are not very difficult to find. You have to have some information, a historical information, like some of that a kind of bookseller, the wise man there. No, Pangloss, not wise. Pangloss is a German metaphysician, and that is by definition something unwise, at least for Voltaire. This other fellow who slaved all his life for the booksellers in Amsterdam. Pan? No. Pierre Bell. So you have to have some minor outside information which is very easy to get by. But there are no real mysteries. As I will then say that a Socratic myth, in contradistinction to the Pythagorean myth, is an account which one tells first of all to children, which only children will accept as literally true, which however is not simply an invention or innovation, but already being held, believed in, or which has come down from a named or unnamed source. An account, in other words, which is not literally true, and supported by a tradition which is more or less shaky, but it is supported by a tradition. The question arises, what then is a myth's solid support if it is not literally true and if the tradition is rather dubious? I will here give only one provisional answer. Let us consider an other kind of untrue account occurring in Plato, which is not called a myth and which no one ever called a myth, as far as I know. And this is a description of democracy in the 8th book of the Republic. This is an extremist attack on democracy, which manifestly runs counter to facts known to both Socrates and Plato. To mention only one point, in democracy no one will ever be punished, let alone capitally punished. People who have been condemned to death walk around and nothing happens to them. Well, Plato knew the case of Socrates. And Socrates knew the case, some other cases, for example, the terror in 415, you know the story of...
The Argonauts General?
No, that was a bit later. But the Argonauts you can also take. But the many political trials where the condemned people were, of course, put to death without any hesitation. Now, this description of this atrociously untrue description corresponds, however, to Adeimantos' dream. Adeimantos is a man to whom Socrates talks when he describes the Moses. And the 563b in the Republic. Now, for some reason, Socrates thinks it opportune in this situation to play up to Adeimantos' very strong anti-democratic prejudices. And he tests him in a way by seeing that he accepts, swallows this hook, line, and sinker. Now, if we generalize from that, we could, regarding myths, we could say Platonic myths are, to some extent at any rate, dreams in which a soul reveals itself, a mirror of a soul, the desire or eros of a soul. And then a Socratic myth would be something, a story by which Socrates reveals to his addressee the innermost longings of the addressee, or perhaps of Socrates himself. Perhaps the myth in the Phaedrus, which is distinguished from all other myths by the fact that the only myth in which Socrates speaks of a super heavenly place. All other myths deal with earthly, subterraneous, or earthly things, or heaven even, but none deals with super heavenly things. Perhaps the myth in the Phaedrus is the one in which Socrates reveals his innermost longing to Phaedrus, his longing for unqualified beauty, free from everything ugly or bad. And incidentally, regarding the myth at the end of the Gorgias, I would say this myth is meant to cure Callicles, in a way to hold him a mirror of his soul. And but in this case, of course, Socrates proves to be wholly ineffective. Now, this is what I wanted to say about the myth, to keep this perhaps in mind, and perhaps it will prove to be helpful to you when you come across another myth. Mr. Reichen.
About that myth that failed, does it hold a mirror to Callicles of his soul as it is, or of his soul as Socrates feels it could be and should
or
be?
Or as he should view it, perhaps. As Callicles should view the future of his soul, namely in hell. And not where he is completely naked. I mean, where there are no longer any trimmings there, you know, badges or any other things derived from wealth or honor, and where he is looked at by or judged by judges who cannot be fooled. Whereas if he is accused before an Athenian jury, if he has a very clever defender, or maybe if he himself has acquired the art of forensic rhetoric, then he can of course fool the judges easily. But if he is down and confronted with unfoolable judges, if one can say so, and in addition, there is no way he doesn't appear as this marvelous, striking man, but simply a naked, completely naked. So, then he will see himself truly. Good. Mr. Flaumner?
Your account of the myth seems to address the first point. That is, it's something that's not literally true. What's the connection between your account and the fact that myths told by Socrates usually have some basis in something, things that are held by people?
Yeah, but Protagoras doesn't refer to anything, and he makes a certain tacit use of stories about Prometheus, but no, he doesn't deem it in any way necessary to have a support by authority.
So what significance do you attach to the fact that Socrates, in front of the distinction to the Sophists,
yes,
does feel the need to appeal to these commonly
known? Well, Socrates is more modest. He doesn't have the nerve. And you see, it fits, of course, perfectly with into the picture of Protagoras' contempt for antiquity, of which we have seen some traces. We will find some more.
Well, there's a would also have to do with the fact that Socrates recognized that to be convincing, a myth has to seem to be something that's eternally true and an old story and so forth, whereas Protagoras doesn't realize what's important in terms of convincing someone. He just makes one up to...
How come? Because he is sure he's such an excellent new Orpheus that he can charm everybody. And people will not ask for any proofs if he has said so in his beautifully phrased and intonated sentences. Now let us continue at this point.
And that you may not suppose yourself to be deceived.
Yeah, now let us stop here. He refers here to the danger of deception. By what? By the myth, of course. The mythical ground or cause which he has given does not give a guarantee that it has an effect which is real, as we say, which is being, as it is. The myth is an account of the origins, as we have said. How, where does virtue come from, where do the arts come from, and so on. Well, think from the Bible, the explanation of the peculiar relation of the two sexes by the story of Eve framed from Adam's rib. The fact which we know is that there is a certain relation between the two sexes. They need each other, they cling to each other, and there is a certain inferiority of the female sex. I'm not stating my own opinion. And the way of expressing is that Eve came after Adam. A myth may also be an account of origins of things which are not. For example, there may be a myth about the origin of centaurs. Then the centaurs are not, and therefore the origins of the centaurs are not. Yeah? Surely the visible effects are better known than the mythical causes. But apart from this essential effect of myth as myth, this particular myth has this special effect that it renders impossible Protagoras' art, as we have seen. If the political art equal to political virtue is a gift of Zeus, why do we need human teachers? As I said, Protagoras' choice of the myth was a bad choice, and therefore he must now not leave it as a myth, but supplement the myth, which he does quite cleverly, but this cleverness must not conceal from us the fact that it is only a remedy for a primary ineptness. Now let us begin the sentence again and read it.
And that you may not suppose yourself to be deceived in thinking that all men actually do regard every man as having a share of justice and of every other political virtue, let me give you a further proof, which is this.
Yes. All, what is the point, what is the fact of which the myth has given the cause? All human beings believe that every hombre must partake of justice and the other political virtue. Protagoras does not say that in fact every hombre is just or must be just, etc. Still less that all human beings, women, slaves, etc., must be just. So it is very little what he demands. That men believe, and they may be absolutely mistaken, of course. But the fact that they believe that is now established by Protagoras on non-mythical grounds, because the myth somehow doesn't fill the bill. Yes?
In other cases, as you are aware, if a man says...
No, in the case of the other virtues, as you say,
In case of other virtues, as you say, if a man says that he is a good flute player or skillful in any other art in which he has no skill, people either laugh at him or are angry with him, and his relations think that he is mad and go and admonish him.
Yeah, you see here how he uses virtue and technique and art synonymously. That's not Socrates, it's Pythagoras, yes?
But when justice is in question, or some other political virtue, even if they know that he is unjust, yet if the man of his own accord comes publicly forward and tells the truth, then what in the other case was held by them to be good sense, i.e. to tell the truth.
Sophrosyne, let us say, let us keep the term moderation, although it doesn't make the apparently makes sense here, but that's important. Yes?
What was said to be moderation, that is, to tell the truth, they now deem to be madness. They said that all men ought to profess justice, whether they are just
or
not.
Yeah, but all men ought to profess that they are just. I mean, professing justice is too general a translation. Yeah? Quite a few people profess justice without claiming that they are just, yes?
Whether they are just or not, and that a man is out of his mind who says anything else.
Yeah, who does not raise his claim to just, so he's being just. And what does this prove?
Their notion is that a man must have some degree of justice, and that if he has none at all, he ought not to be in human society.
In other words, it is necessary that everyone should participate in justice in whichever way. Now, which is the case here stated as this limit, this interesting limit case. How does this man here discussed participate in justice? Pardon?
By claiming to be just.
In other words, sheer hypocrisy. Now, you see here, moderation, Sophrosyne, is here used as the opposite of insanity or madness. That is, it shows you the spread of the meaning of this Greek term. Good. Now, why it is moderate not to claim or pretend to possess a virtue or art other than the political, which one does not possess, it is moderate, sensible, to claim or pretend to possess justice, even if one does not possess it. So much do men believe that everyone who wishes to live among men must somehow participate in justice. The appearance of justice, nay, the pretense to justice, is perfectly sufficient, fills the bill. The alleged gift of Zeus is in fact a mere pretense. Zeus has given men the possibility to claim that they are just, to pretend they are just, and some of course are also just, that is not denied. But this, so justice is radically by convention. Is there's nothing natural in it, yes.
Isn't there a certain point here that because all men believe that all men participate in justice, a man who does not even make the claim that he is just is by definition not a man?
Yeah, right, at least he's not that.
I mean, if he doesn't even admit that there is such a thing as justice or something, then
no,
he,
no,
no,
that's not the one. He doesn't say that there is no such thing as justice. What he literally says is, I am an unjust man. And he may do this from a sense of repentance for it. But in most cases, I believe that if someone, even today, that if someone would say, I committed a crime and I have to do that, I believe in many cases, his relatives would say, don't do that. Make up for it in any other way. Perhaps by sending the damaged family a check or so, But don't do that. You will compromise your. Think of your children. They have the reputation. Their father was in jail. You know, you can easily go down. But the key point here is what is decisive is what Protagoras means by the gift of Zeus comes now up. It is a mere external, mere varnish. By the way, Protagoras, we know this from another Platonic dialogue, the Theaetetus, according to which Protagoras has said that the just, the noble, and the pious things are all by convention. It's explicitly ascribed there in the Theaetetus 167c, 172a to b, and 177c. Men do. And the, of course, a further consequence of this is since this is sufficient, is that men do not believe that all men are or must be just. They believe only that a man who doesn't claim to be just is mad. Regarding one's justice, it is just to be unjust, one can say, namely to lie. Lying being one kind of injustice. There was Mr. Schaefer.
Well, isn't it possible that Zeus gave to some men the ability to partake in justice by claiming to be just only, and also gave to other men, or even to most men, the ability to be just actually?
Yes, but when you look back at 322d, what Zeus said to Hermes, you will see that Zeus said in very unequivocal language, give it to all. And all must participate in it. And he doesn't make this nice distinction.
Well, is it possible that he could give it to all and yet in different ways?
Yeah, but there is no doubt. That this is a radical correction of the myth.
Well, the discussion seems to have shifted in this part to justice, to dikaiosune, and maybe this is where maybe the fact is that everyone has the sense of shame. I mean, everyone, because the Zeus gave two things: the sense of shame.
I see. That's good. That's good.
And
in other words, the sense of shame can be identified with hypocrisy, and as it were, ennobles hypocrisy. That's a good point. Will it be recorded that Mr. Schlitzky made it? Fine. Now let us go on.
Okay. I have been showing that they are right in admitting every man as a counselor about this sort of virtue, as they are of opinion that every man is a partaker of it. And I would
Because they believe, not that it's factually the case. They believe everyone must partake.
And I will now endeavor to show further that they do not conceive this virtue to be given by nature or to grow spontaneously, but to be a thing which is taught and which comes to a man by taking pains. No one would instruct, no one would rebuke or be angry with those who...
No, let us stop here first. Now, the participation in justice and the other part of the virtue is due not to nature, of course, nor to divine gift, that's also clear by now, but to human agency. To which human agency? To teaching, we must see. That will be developed in the sequel. Because he must, of course, say that men acquire it by teaching, otherwise he loses the basis of his claim, his professional claim. Yes.
No one would instruct, no one would rebuke or be angry with those whose calamities they suppose to be due to nature or chance. They do not try to punish or to prevent them from being what they are. They do but pity them. Who, for example, is so foolish as to chastise or instruct the ugly, the diminutive, or the feeble? And for this reason, because he knows that good and evil of this kind is the work of nature and of chance, Whereas, if a man is wanting in those good qualities which are attained by study and exercise and teaching...
Now let us stop here. How did he call these qualities? What was the common name in his translation for this kind, like being beautiful and tall and strong? How did he call them? Well, in Greek at any rate, he calls them the beautiful or noble things and their opposites. Yeah, I mean, that's the thought is doesn't require any. There, no one is indignant about another man's bodily defects. They can annoy him, but he cannot, as a sensible man, blame him. The noble or beautiful things, that's important, are by nature or by chance. And this implies justice does not belong to the noble things. But to what? Here a distinction has to be considered, which is crucial, for example, in Plato's Republic, but also elsewhere, between the noble or fine or beautiful and the necessary. Justice may be necessary without being beautiful. The clearest case of the non-coincidence of the just and the beautiful is a case of punishment. It is beautiful, noble, fine, praiseworthy. That if we act justly, but not in all cases. For example, if we punish someone justly, that's also praiseworthy. But if someone is punished justly, that is nothing of which he can be proud of. It is nothing admirable. It is nothing beautiful. It is not, but it is necessary. So in other words, the key implication here of the expression, the noble things used here without any qualification, is justice does not belong to the noble. Justice is, if it is of any value, a necessity. Well, take an ordinary example from a different sphere. To undergo an operation for appendectomy, to say nothing of harsher diseases, is necessary from time to time, but no one could ever say it is something noble, praiseworthy, fine, beautiful. His conduct towards the operation, maybe, but not the thing itself. Yeah? So, good, let us go on here.
And saying
no, they, I believe, because they know that these, the noble things and the opposite, come to man by nature and as well as by chance. Yes.
Whereas, if a man is wanting in those good qualities which are obtained by study and exercise and teaching, and has only the contrary evil qualities, other men are angry with him and punish and reprove him.
Yeah, let us stop here. Of the political virtue, men believe, that's implied, that it comes about by these three things here mentioned, taking care of, care, and training, ascesis, from which asceticism, right, and plain teaching. The training is in the center. You must act habitually in order to acquire the habit, as Aristotle explained later. So, in other words, it is not so clear that the political art, political or the political virtue is acquired exclusively by teaching. There may be these other things, this habitual acting, this training, may also be necessary. Yes?
Is it important in any way that in the first three he mentions, the ugly, the diminutive, or the feeble, that the diminutive is the center of the
sentence? You're sure it must explain why this is the center. One would, it would, because of the emphasis on the noble or beautiful, the ugly would be more natural in the center. There must be some reason. I do not know the reason, but the question is well taken.
Sure.
Yes. Now let us read the immediate sequence.
Of these evil qualities, one is injustice, another impiety, and they may be described generally as the very opposite of political virtue. In such cases, any...
Now let us stop here for a moment. The question arises, he says here, of which one is both injustice and impiety, and generally speaking, all the opposites of political virtue. And the position of that one is ambiguous and gives rise to the question that there may be other things than political virtue, the absence of which gives rise to indignation. We would have to consider that. But here he speaks of justice, piety, and the rest of the political virtue. And that is very strange, because there is no reference to the gods in Protagoras' non-mythical speech. In the myth all the time. We see here, formerly he had spoken of justice and moderation. Now he speaks of justice and piety. Piety takes the place of moderation. Sophrosyne, which is the opposite not only of madness, but of hubris as well. This one simply has to know, of course the first source we had for such things is Aristotle's Ethics, with its precise and detailed descriptions and definitions. But Aristotle uses the word sophrosyne in the very narrow sense where it means only temperance regarding sensible pleasures. But that's a very limited meaning. It means something like sobriety, not only regarding intoxicating beverages, but also in regarding to the other things which intoxicate us, like success or whatever it may be. And therefore it means sanity in a very broad sense, opposed to insanity, but also that aspect of sanity according to which we are reminded of man's limitations of man as man, and therefore in opposition to hubris. This is all here implied. Yes, now let us read here from here on now larger. So let us not forget the main point. Protagoras tries to prove that virtue is, and in particular political virtue, is teachable. And the sign is that regarding other things, men are not blamed for their lack of it. Whereas regarding the lack of political virtue, they are blamed, and people get angry at them. Now let us go on from this point. Let us read the end of this passage. Yes, Mr. Lange. In his cradle, what Rousseau says is there is no city, no civil society without family, and no family without sexual love. Rousseau sees very clearly, incidentally, the anti-erotic character of the Republic as a whole. But sexual love is, of course, not simply natural, according to Rousseau. That's the difficulty. And the city natural is still less. The conclusion on page 326 in the fourth paragraph. And then I believe it's the next paragraph.
When once it is proved that men and women are and ought to be unlike in constitution and in temperament, it follows that their education must be different. Nature teaches us that they should work together, but that each has its own share of the work. The end is the same, but the means are different, as are also the feelings which direct them.
The tastes. Yeah. Go on.
But we have attempted to paint a natural man. Let us try to paint a helpmate for him.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
That's all we need. after having tried to form the natural man, in order not to leave our work imperfect, let us see how the woman convenient to that man must be formed. He does not say the natural woman. That is surely intention. Woman cannot be natural in the way in which men say. Now what does that mean? What was the natural result of our observations regarding the natural character of Emile's education? In what sense is his education natural? We have seen it is terribly artificial, but in one sense it is natural.
No prejudice.
The woman without prejudice is not even desirable and not even possible. And the principle is stated very clearly at the bottom of page 327.
When I consider the special purpose of woman, when I observe her inclinations or reckon up her duties, everything combines to indicate the mode of education she requires. Men and women are made for each other, but their mutual dependence differs in degree.
Is not equal.
Is not equal.
Yeah.
Man is dependent on woman through his desires. Woman is dependent on man through her desires and also through her needs. He can do without her better than she can do without him. She cannot fulfill her purpose in life without
him. But this sentence, I'm sorry, you see here the distinction he makes between desire and need. Sex is a desire, but not a need. So, by the way, that confirms perfectly what we have found in the earlier passage. I will make a reference to that. Good. And now, go on, please.
She cannot fulfill her purpose in life without his aid, without his goodwill, without his respect. She is dependent on our feelings, on the price we put upon her virtue, and the opinion we have of her charms and her deserts. Nature herself has decreed that woman, both
in the Republic, for certain reasons, is called the idea of the good. Now, if, however, it is the unity, the unifying thing, the yoke, where is our thing? It must also fulfill another question. Let's take here an idea. There is something which is distinguished from them, not only the individual things, but the dog. Yeah, the individual, say the dog, and the idea of dog, and the dog. There is also something which we call intellection, the human act. Include the acts of intellection.